to Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio and the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11. It's co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today we're talking about national security and authoritarianism and much more. We have Melvin Loeffler. He is the Edward Stettinius Professor of American History at the University of Virginia. He's an expert on U.S. foreign relations and national security. He served in the office of the Secretary of Defense during the Carter administration, where he worked on arms control and contingency planning. He's the author of many books on the Cold War, political economy, and national security, for which he has won numerous awards. His new book, Safeguarding Democratic Capitalism, is an account of the development of U.S. national security policy, including how to safeguard American security and economic interests in the increasingly challenging world. And we have here with us Kirill Kunakovich. He is a historian of modern Europe with a focus on Central and Eastern Europe in the 20th century. His latest book is entitled Culture for the People, Art and Politics in Communist Poland and East Germany. It considers how arts and culture helped to make and then unmake the Soviet bloc. We'll also discuss the nationalist rally that occurred just last weekend in Poland. So I wanted to let you know you can check out all our past shows on the station website, 947wpvc.org, including this one, chock full of amazing people we've had the chance to interview. And Nancy, are you there?
Ellen, I am here. Look at what we're doing on a Saturday morning. Well, actually, we're not doing much. We're just asking questions. But look at what we're providing for people this Saturday morning. I mean, that's amazing, as always. You paint a beautiful picture of what is happening in the next hour, I have to say. I will continue to say. Don't stop.
And again, the picture is painted because we have amazing guests here with us.
I know. And Mel and Kirill. I mean, what are the chances? Apparently very high.
So there's an endangered elephant in the room, Nancy.
Yeah, I have heard of this, and I actually heard that they are, because of the backlash about what, you know, as his normal undoing everything Obama did strategy, that I read that he is postponing, or it's back on, it's in limbo, that he may in fact undo that ruling that Obama made about protecting. So you knew that.
I knew that. Yeah, I'm really glad. I think we need to keep the pressure up. That is, I think, why. It's hard to imagine that it actually made a difference, but I know Ellen DeGeneres did a big push. So just keep pushing and talking about it, I guess.
Well, I agree, of course. I but not that you said this, but I am not convinced it is over. You know, I just feel like once the next 10 fires are lit, if he needs to sign something, or if it just needs a whatever it needs, I'm pretty sure it's going to get done, and we'll find out about it when the next 10 fires are extinguished.
Well, the Washington Post has been doing some tracking, and I don't know if this is going to work, but I'm going to try something right here. All right,
let's try.
Rock Hits 92.3 receives support from Burbish Grill.
Hi, I'm Jason Payne, managing partner of the...
Well, it's a live show. Okay. It's a live show, and my beautiful music didn't come up, but I just want to talk about all the lies. So Orange Cheeto, otherwise known as Trump, has made...
I have no idea who you're addressing.
He's made...
Thank you for clarifying.
1,628 false or misleading claims since taking office in the last 298 days.
Yeah, well...
That's 5.5 lies a day, according to the Washington Post.
It's a lot of winning.
I know. And maybe we should have a new segment just called Lies.
Then we won't have guests on.
That's true.
Want you to know. That'll be the end of what we do here. Anyway, no, I'm sorry. You were saying.
No, and also, speaking of lies, the tax plan, they keep saying that it's great for the middle class. All it's doing is helping wealthy donors and no one else.
Right. No, I have a number to share.
Yes,
I know
please
that
do.
The top 1% will get about 80% of those tax cuts, and the top 0.1% will get 40% so of those tax cuts. So it is so lopsided, which, you know, it's like if, how many times do we have to fight? And I know we're still not done because they put some of Obamacare into this tax plan, but the number of times that returns, I cannot imagine what we are going to have to go through to see. Actually, I'm not even, you know, to see if we can stop this.
Right. I mean, it's
upside down plan.
It scares me because people are seem less aware of it or what it's really going to do.
Yeah, totally. I agree, and I wonder if some of that is timing. You know, I mean, it is right now. Everyone is, you know, it's getting towards the holidays. And not that people, believe me, I know when their insurance is on the line, you know, we show up. But I have wondered about the timing of it and the relentlessness of all the other fights that, it worries me too.
And I know I've learned a lot, you know, through being so alarmed about all this. Apparently, so if they have such a big tax cut, they're going to have to fund it. And where's it going to come from? So I heard one quote of $25 billion will come out of Medicare. They're going to cut all kinds of programs. And then say there's a deficit and hopefully not force Democrats to vote on these things.
Right. I know they're in a tough bind because if they do nothing, then if they refuse to address that thing, the pay-as-you-go thing that will automatically cut into Medicare and social services and things for the poor. If the Democrats do nothing, then that pay as you go plan goes into effect. So if they like want to put their foot down to the whole thing, those cuts will happen. And if they want to negotiate, therefore that, you know, remedy the Medicare part of this, then they're sort of playing ball with this horrible tax plan. You know.
Mm-hmm. So one thing to do, it's so easy. I mean, when I hear people telling me to call my representatives, congresswomen, I don't love the thought of doing it, but I do it. But here's something so easy. You text 50409. If you haven't done it before, you text a trigger word resist, and then the bot will ask you questions. It'll ask you what message you want to write. You type it in. It could be don't support the tax bill, something simple, and then a whole letter is generated, and they know who your representative is. So that text number is 50409, and they fax these letters. It's quite amazing.
Wow.
So that's what I would encourage people to do because it's going past the House. Now it's going to the Senate.
Right. I know. Right. And that's great, Ellen. I'm glad there's a bot out there that's not Russian.
Right.
Nice to know.
Yes, I know. I almost hesitated to use that word. And then I wanted to point to an event happening November 29th. Someone named Ruby Sales is coming here to the Jefferson School. That's a Wednesday from 6 to 7:30. Now, she is a nationally recognized civil rights leader. She was a student freedom fighter in the 60s. She speaks on race, religion, language, and politics. And I heard her on the Krista Tippett show talking about a spiritual that slaves sang. And she said, in the midst of the constant suffering that we can't even fathom that slaves endured, they would sing a song called "You Can't Make Me Hate You." So it was a really powerful, poignant moment. So she's going to be here the 29th of November.
Cool. That sounds great.
Yeah.
That's still during open enrollment, you know.
Thanks for mentioning.
It finishes, December 15th, and you've probably heard it's like double. I am shocked. It is so far double what it was the year before, the number of new people. I am totally shocked.
Yeah.
People are actually getting the message that it is available. You know, the enrollment period is now.
Yes.
Okay.
So with no further ado, let's get to our first guest. He is Melvin Loeffler, the Edward Stettinius Professor of American History at the University of Virginia and the Compton Visiting Professor at UVA's Miller Center. He's the author of several books on the Cold War, including For the Soul of Mankind, which won a prize from the American Historical Association, and A Preponderance of Power, which won the Bancroft, Hoover, and Farrell Prizes. Loeffler previously served as president of the Society of Historians of American Foreign Relations. He has a plentiful collection of awards and honors, and we are honored to have him here. His most recent book of many is Safeguarding Democratic Capitalism, U.S. Foreign Policy and National Security, 1920 to 2015. Welcome, Mel.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Good. So, Nancy, I wanted to give you the honors.
Oh, okay.
Would you ask
Mel,
the first question?
It's coming from me then instead.
Excellent.
The the notion of foreign policy and national security, how did they get interlinked starting? What was it about World War II that started the road to those two things getting connected?
Well, a very important aspect of World War II was the effort of the United States and its principal allies to stop the capacity of the Axis nations, Nazi Germany, Italy, and Japan, from gaining control of most of Europe and Asia. And the perception in Washington was that should that happen, should Nazi Germany defeat Soviet Russia, should it defeat the United Kingdom, both of which seemed possible in 1940, 41, and 42, American policymakers were of the conviction that the domination of Europe and Asia by an Axis coalition would force significant changes inside the United States and really alter the American way of life. Why would this happen? Because if the Axis fascist Nazi powers dominated Europe and Asia, it would mean that the United States would have to rearm and become a militaristic state, something that Americans had eschewed for all of its history. The term that was often used was that the United States would have to become a garrison state. Inside a garrison state, American liberties would be circumscribed, and the role of government over the economy would increase in order to deal with the competition of Axis nations. So what became linked was the idea that foreign policy and national security were linked to the American way of life inside the United States. This is a critical view. National security became linked to foreign policy because the most vital interests, that is the basic core values of Americans, freedom of speech, individual liberty, representative government, a private marketplace economy, all these things were perceived to be at risk if an Axis coalition gained control of Europe and Asia. So the relationship between foreign policy and domestic core values, the basic institutions of the United States, were perceived as being linked to one another.
And why did the U.S. become the leader of all of the nations? You know, that was right when they projected their power to the world. They became the top of the democratic standard or whatever.
Well, that's because at the end of World War II, the United States was, in effect, the only major nation that escaped from World War II unscathed. For the most part, the United States did not experience any of the type of internal devastation that every other major nation in Europe and Asia faced, so that the traditional core allies or natural allies of the United States, meaning Britain and France and other countries in Western Europe like the Netherlands and Belgium, all of these nations were devastated by the war. And at the end of World War II in 1945, 1946, the United States dominated the international economy. It's often perceived that at the end of the war, a bipolar relationship emerged between the United States on the one hand and the Soviet Union on the other, because the Soviet Union at the end of the war dominated Eastern and Central Europe. But the idea of a bipolar system totally misconstrues the degree to which the United States dominated the international economy at the end of World War II. Its power was unmatched. It had strategic weapons. It had the atomic bomb. It had a strategic air force. Its navy dominated the seas. So the United States became the leader of the so-called free world, because its own potential allies were extremely weak and had to face the challenges of post-war reconstruction. And the United States became the leader of the free world because it was the nation most capable of containing the power and the ideological appeal of Soviet communism.
You're listening to Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC. We're speaking with Professor Melvin Loeffler. He is a professor of history at the University of Virginia. And I wanted to bring it to today a little bit. So what is your view of what is going on with the Trump administration, if you can call it foreign policy, his relationships that he seems to have, and what he's creating? What is your view?
That's a great question. And I mean, one of the and it relates exactly to what the previous questions were alluding to. At the end of World War II, the United States assumed a number of policies, including commitments to strategic alliances in Europe, including commitments to an international organization, the United Nations, including commitments to multilateral institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. All of these undertakings by the United States at the end of World War II were aimed at creating a liberal capitalist international order. And the viewpoint was, as I indicated earlier, that a liberal capitalist international order was essential for the preservation of America's core values and the American way of life inside the United States. So the United States assumed a set of policies at the end of World War II that shaped the entire subsequent course of American foreign relations and national security policy throughout the Cold War and after the Cold War, because after the Cold War was over in the 1990s, American policymakers, both Republicans and Democrats, both George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and Barack Obama, all of these people were committed to sustaining the liberal capitalist international order through alliances, multilateral initiatives, open and free trade. These were the essential ingredients of American foreign policy and national security until Donald Trump was elected president of the United States. So, in effect, President Trump, to the extent that we understand his foreign policies, is repudiating the entire legacy of American foreign policy and national security that emerged after World War II. He is repudiating the policies that empowered the United States to become the unquestioned leader of the free world. He is repudiating the policies that enabled the United States to project not only its hard power abroad, but its soft power, because it was perceived, sometimes wrongly, but nonetheless perceived as the champion of freedom and democracy around the world. President Trump is repudiating all these policies. He repudiates it in the following ways. He's not for open international trade. He's not for supporting the multilateral institutions that have been so instrumental in strengthening America's worldwide economic presence. He wants to repudiate the treaties and the agreements and the alliances. Moreover, Trump loves to engage authoritarian, repressive leaders abroad. He just returned from a trip to East Asia, where he embraced the leader of the Philippines. The leader of the Philippines is known for supporting the murder of thousands, probably approximately 10,000 alleged drug dealers, that he just supports literally the murder of them and openly says that that's the policy of the Filipino government. Donald Trump has embraced this man. Donald Trump, as everyone knows, is eager to embrace Vladimir Putin, the leader of Russia. These efforts to embrace repressive dictatorial leaders is a aberration of what American foreign policy has stood for, even though at times we have compromised those policies for expedient reasons. We've never really fully wanted to go ahead and embrace them, as has Donald Trump.
Thank you, Melvin Loeffler. We're talking about foreign policy with him. He is the professor of American history at the University of Virginia. We're going to come back with more with Professor Loeffler and also Kirill Kunakovich. He's a historian also of a different part of Europe, or the Eastern Bloc, I should say, and we will be back right after this. Welcome back. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We're talking with Melvin Loeffler. He's the Edward Stettinius, of course.
Allow me.
You could tell us a little bit about Edward R. Stettinius later.
Okay.
So could you continue with the line you were going at with how Trump's been repudiating all policy?
Yeah, well, Donald Trump loves to talk about America first. I mean, his position, his foreign policy is summed up by America first. If you go to the presidential website for the White House and look at the president's statement on foreign policy, it is called America First. What's paradoxical and about this is that America's standing and posture in the world has actually declined precipitously since he became president. He just returned from his trip to Asia, in which he said he loved to see the revival of America's image and stature abroad. He was welcomed everywhere with great pomp and ceremony and respect. But if you look at polling and what people actually say about the United States, it is really illuminating right now. The Pew Charitable Trust conducts polling abroad, and one of the questions they ask people in many different countries is, you know, what do you think that the American president can be relied on to do the right thing at the time of a crisis? And during the latter years of the Obama administration, you know, roughly 60-70% of people abroad in different countries, it varied in different countries, and in one or two countries like Russia and Israel, the response was very poor. But for most of the world, the vast majority of the world, people said, yes, the American president can be counted upon by approximately 60-70% of the people in these many countries. A few months ago, when they were polled again in the time of Trump, when they were asked, can the American president be relied upon, the positive response was about 20-odd percent. It varied, of course, in different countries. But if you look across the board, the expectation that President Trump would do the right thing in a crisis had plummeted. The notion of America first is a captivating notion. Put America first. He presents this as if other presidents had never thought of putting America first. But in fact, all American presidents since World War II have thought about putting America first. No one has wanted to sacrifice or compromise America's interests and values. No single president. The real issue is how to go about safeguarding American interests and values, how you do this. And most American presidents, as I indicated earlier, had a set of policies that were designed to revitalize and stabilize a liberal international order where both democratic and capitalist institutions could flourish around the globe. In effect, Donald Trump, as I said earlier, is repudiating this by simply emphasizing buy American, hire American. He's suggesting a very protectionist, nationalist foreign policy that, if implemented, actually would isolate the United States from most of its allies in the world and actually erode American strength vis-a-vis its adversaries. So, for example, he was just in Asia, where he happily repeated that the United States would never become part of the Trans-Pacific Pact, something that previous administrations had supported, not only Democratic administration, but also Republican administration. And Donald Trump has repudiated the Trans-Pacific Pact. The Trans-Pacific Pact is an agreement of most nations, except China, that border on the Pacific, mostly in East Asia, in which they are committing themselves to promote trade with one another and to reduce tariffs and to stop the impediments to the flow of services and finance. This was a means not only to increase America's economic interests, but also was a way of augmenting, a way of strengthening America's geopolitical influence in the region when China's power is emerging. The repudiation of the Trans-Pacific Pact, the absence of anything to replace it, erodes America's strength, puts America not first, but actually last. That's what is so aggravating to most informed observers of what's going on. Donald Trump's policies are just fraught with inconsistencies. Take the tax package, which Nancy and Ellen, both of you, were talking about at the onset of this program. If taxes are cut, it will mean an increase in trade deficits, exactly the opposite of what Donald Trump says must happen. All economists, the vast majority of all economists, Republican and Democrat, liberal and conservative, will tell you that if taxes are cut, it almost automatically leads to an increase in trade deficits. Nonetheless, Donald Trump says almost every day that the key to evaluating America's strength in the world is the degree to which America's trade deficits decrease. But his tax plan is, in effect, inevitably going to increase the trade deficit. Moreover, if you look at Donald Trump's tax plan, the major justification for it is that it's supposedly going to increase economic growth. How is it going to increase economic growth? Allegedly, it's going to increase economic growth because it's going to reduce the taxation on American corporations from 35% to 20%. The notion behind this is that American corporations pay much higher tax than their competitors abroad. And almost everyone would tell you who's looked into this that this is simply not true, because although the statutory rate is 35% on American corporations, almost all American corporations pay much lower taxes. It's estimated that the average large corporation in the United States pays about 18%, which is actually a little lower than foreign competitors. So the notion that you need to reduce taxes on big corporations in order to augment their competitive ability is simply flawed. It's not true. Moreover, the irony is that American private corporations today are enjoying the highest profits in their history. They don't need reduced taxes if they wanted to invest. They have plenty of money to invest. And nor does this tax plan, this reduction on tax corporations, require corporations in any way whatsoever to do the things that will really help American workers, like increase wages. The notion is that it will trickle down to that. But historically, we know, literally, we know empirically, that what corporations do in these situations is that they buy back stock. rather than increase wages. They actually pay higher stock options to their largest corporate executives. This policy is not a policy that is going to enhance America's competitive ability in the international economy. So, in short, Donald Trump's policies are flawed, they're inconsistent, and they will undermine America's primacy in the international arena.
Can I just bring a recording of this to my Thanksgiving dinner?
Yes. Why don't you just invite me for a good Thanksgiving dinner?
You're invited. I mean, please. I would love to have you in my back pocket, just, you know, whip it out and just say, please talk about foreign policy to all these people. Thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Yes,
thank you for inviting me.
Totally appreciate the passion and the, as Ellen sort of alluded to, just the concrete, unavoidable facts about what he's doing to the rest of, to us and the rest of the world, sadly, as well.
We're going to corner you and ask you if you'd come back. Would you?
I'd love to. Yes.
All right.
Thank you.
Great. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you so much. So coming up is Kirill Kunakovich, historian of modern Europe and focusing on Central and Eastern Europe. I'm looking forward to talking about a little bit about the Poland rally. But Nancy.
I do.
Yes.
I don't need to be psychic.
Yeah.
Were you going to ask me, Ellen, if I have a news of note?
Yes.
Okay. Well, okay. So I was being psychic. Yes, I have one. Trump has nominated, change of pace, back to home front. Trump has nominated Brett Talley, a 36-year-old partisan blogger who has pledged his support in his blogs, among other things, pledged his support for the NRA. Trump has nominated him just 3 years out of law school. He's never tried a case in court to be an Alabama federal district judge, which is a lifetime appointment. He has received a rare, unanimous, not qualified rating from the American Bar Association. They've only given out, I think, two or three of those before, unanimous, unqualified. And last week it was revealed, though he didn't put it on his forms, that he's married to the chief of staff of the White House counsel, Don McGahn, who oversees Trump's judicial nominations. And despite all of this, the Senate Judiciary Committee voted party line to proceed to Senate confirmation vote, which could come on Monday. This guy might be a federal judge for life as of Monday. I think they need like four Republicans to vote no, and the, you know, in the big big Senate floor. But who knows?
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up because that's really, really bothering me because those are lifetime appointments.
Yeah,
that's
what he is accomplishing. After everyone always says there's no legislation, he's doing so much to the court. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Anyway.
So mine is, there was an accord, the Paris, the UN Climate Change Conference was in Bonn, Germany this past week. And the U.S. was there touting coal, of all things. But the positive side, if there can be one, is that there were a bunch of people, businesses, mayors like Michael Bloomberg, who were there as a delegation from the U.S. So it was the first time that there was more than one delegation from the U.S. You had Trump promoting coal and nuclear and a collection of cities and universities and businesses. And L.A. Times said that they were tacitly usurping the government role, trying to let the international community know lots of people back the Paris Agreement. And Bloomberg said that promoting coal at a climate summit is like promoting tobacco at a cancer summit, obviously. So, and then one other thing I wanted to read from the Times, this is so interesting, the loud and colorful U.S. coalition of cities and states that supports the Paris Agreement and action against climate change not only stole the show in Bonn with its gigantic pavilion featuring free beer and high-spirited panel discussions, but it managed to help galvanize the other 195 countries in the Paris Pact against the Trump administration. So I'm just happy to hear that.
I feel like this is like we're citizens of Russia trying to tell the rest of the world, it's just them, it's not us. Well, right. We totally get it.
Right. I cannot wait to talk to Kirill about some of that. So I'm going to introduce him. We're going to have a couple minutes before a hard break, and we will have plenty of time to talk with Kirill Kunakovich. So welcome, Kirill.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, you're welcome. I'm going to read a little introduction for you.
Uh-oh.
You know, one day, could I get a producer here, you know, to help me? Today was not a great day for multitasking. But, okay, Kirill Konakovich, really looking forward to talking to him. He's a historian of modern Europe with a focus on Central and Eastern Europe in the 20th century. His latest book is entitled Culture for the People, Art and Politics in Communist Poland and East Germany. It considers how arts and culture helped to make and then unmake the Soviet bloc. Again, looking forward to talking about the nationalist rally that occurred last weekend. I think we're going to go to a break so I don't have to interrupt you rudely, and we'll be right back. Nancy, what do you think of that?
Okay.
Welcome back, everyone, to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, and Nancy Lawrence in New York City on the phone with us. And we come to you every Saturday from 10 to 11. We are happy to have Kirill Konakovich here with us. We're going to talk about his book, Culture for the People, Art and Politics in Communist Poland and East Germany, and what I've been mentioning throughout. Talk to us about your thoughts about the Poland nationalist rally that happened just last weekend.
I was certainly shocked to see, right? So there were about 60,000 people out on the streets of Warsaw last Saturday, November 11th. November 11th is Armistice Day. It's the end of World War I. And in Poland, it also doubles as Independence Day, since Poland regained independence with the collapse of European empires at the end of the war. And this has always been a major holiday in Poland, even in the communist period. It's a classic Independence Day, flags, parades, parents with children. And this year, we saw a rather different crowd. There were about 60,000 people organized by a group called the National Radical Camp. And all of these demonstrators paraded through the streets, chanting things like White Europe, chanting things like Sieg Heil, Muslims go home. And the pictures are terrifying, and they should be, but this is in many ways not that new and not so surprising. The organization I mentioned, National Radical Camp, was actually founded in the 1930s. It was a fascist, proto-fascist organization then. It was reactivated in the 1990s, has now been on the margins of Polish politics. But the reason that it's coming back and the reason that the crowds are growing has to do with the people in charge of the country. This is a similar effect that we're seeing around the world. Politicians set the tone for what happens across the streets. And in this case, the people in charge are a party called the Law and Justice Party. And that Orwellian name really testifies to a fairly familiar law and order message. This is a group that believes in an ethnic Polish nation state, in the idea of a Poland for the Poles really running in effect on a slogan of make Poland great again. And these kinds of rallies are very much an expression of support for this agenda, an expression of hostility towards immigrants, towards outsiders of any kind. And it demonstrates the reach that that message has had in Polish society, unfortunately.
Do you think it means, I know you said they have done this in the past, it's not unusual, but do you think it means any more today because of the fact that we're now sort of participating in all of this too?
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, historians for years have said or often implied that history kind of ran from west to east, that things happened in Western Europe or in the U.S. and then slowly trickled over to Poland, into Russia. There was a kind of gradient across the continent. And in some ways, what we're seeing now is a reversal of that gradient. History flows from east to west. So many of the things that we're witnessing in Russia, now in Poland, now in Germany and Britain and the United States originate in the east and come to us. And so looking at Poland is, I think, vitally important for us in the U.S. in terms of understanding how our future might look like, what we can do to stop it. And in that sense, there are some really eerie parallels. You know, you guys talked just now about the judicial appointments of the current administration. That has been at the heart of Law and Justice's platform, the way in which the party has really tried to impose itself on the country is, first of all, through media and the control of media. There's a state media in Poland, and its impact is hard to overstate. But secondly, through the judicial system, by removing previously appointed judges who had been given life terms, by claiming that these judges were, in effect, products of the communist system, that they were fifth columnists, that they were not fit to serve an independent Poland. And so for the past few years, the Polish state, the Polish society has been facing this challenge of a judicial controversy, including lots of protests. And again, to a point that you made earlier in the show about civic pressure and what it can do, that's really been the one thing that has been able to put a break on law and justice. People have come out on the streets, people have demonstrated, and it hasn't worked every time, but to the extent that people actually do exercise power in Poland, it seems to be far less through elections and far more through gatherings on the streets. I think that's something for us to keep in mind.
Why does nationalism seem to, anyway, cross into this authoritarian space more than not? Why does it always turn into such a horrible thing?
Yeah, that's a tough one. So I think that element of authoritarianism is always a danger. It's always a threat. I think that's lurking in the concept of nationalism. And it's worth thinking about where the idea of nationalism originates. You know, this concept is much more recent than we think. It's really a 19th century idea. Words like nationalism, we start to see pop up in the late 19th, early 20th century, even though, of course, nations and nationalists present themselves as timeless and eternal. And the origins of the concept have a lot to do with the origins of democracy. They are really intertwined. It's really the French Revolution that brings this idea of a nation. It's really the entry of mass politics onto the political scene in the 19th century that augurs, sets off an age of nationalism. And as a result, I think the concept of nationalism is really closely tied to the idea of democratic politics, to the idea that it is the people who exercise sovereignty, not God, not a king, not an appointed leader, but an elected leader. And that is a wonderful thing. That's the foundation of modern politics, the foundation of democratic governance. But I think within it is this idea that democracy is ultimately for a particular people, for the people somehow defined. And the real contestations of nationalism, the real kind of emergence of authoritarianism, has come in that battle to define the people, who belongs and who doesn't. And unfortunately, I think there's no way to strip that away from democratic politics. I think that danger of a narrow definition, that danger of excluding certain people precisely in order to give rights, in order to give citizenship, that's baked into the whole system. So why it's coming out now? I think in some ways it's a cyclical process. It responds to moments of crisis, moments of instability. It's worth keeping in mind, of course, that a country like Poland is a relatively new sovereign state, at least in the current incarnation. It was reborn after the fall of communism in 1989, so democracy is less than 30 years old. But, of course, I think that novelty applies to even much older European states. The fall of the end of the Cold War, the fall of communism, fall of the Berlin Wall is such a new starting point for many states. The European Union is such a new beginning for many states. And so this is, in some ways, I think, a transitional moment, a new moment, really a critical moment in which those latent tensions are starting to come to the fore.
So just to change directions just a tiny bit, you were talking about the people. One of your courses focuses not as much on leaders of dictatorships, but the people. Can you talk about that? What is it like to live in a dictatorship? Do people in those places feel like they're leading normal lives? And how does it affect their thoughts? And maybe is some of that, here's my little editing of that, is some of that helping? Is that happening to us?
Well, I will confess that part of my desire to teach that course was to think about what people's experiences really are in dictatorships and what we can learn from them. You know, I think we're a long way away from that. I don't want to be alarmist, but I do think that there is a real value in learning from historical experience. And as you mentioned, the really scary thing about life in dictatorships is just how ordinary it can feel, how normal, how unthreatening, how peaceful and happy. And in this course, everything we read is a first-person narrative by somebody who lived through a dictatorship. And I focus on the Nazi dictatorship, the communist dictatorship. We talk also about contemporary Russia to examine how much and how well that fits in. But the common threads are that unless you are yourself a member of a persecuted group, until and unless the state chooses to single you out for greater persecution, everything can feel perfectly normal, even satisfying, because there is a real power to feeling part of the people, to feeling part of a community, to being united. Certainly, many far-right activists in Europe today speak very fondly of that sense of unity of those fascist ideas. It can be satisfying. And it's only when you end up on the other side of it that it feels so so different. And so part of why I wanted to teach this course, part of why I think it's important for all of us to be thinking about it, is to remind ourselves that there are outs, that there are alternatives, that in fact there's a great deal of agency and power, even when it doesn't seem that way, that one of the strengths that people have in dictatorships is nonconformity, that even simple acts of disobedience, but of non-participation, become really powerful statements. You know, a very influential essay written in one dictatorship in communist Czechoslovakia in the 1970s by a dissident named Václav Havel, who would later become president of the country, was called The Power of the Powerless. And the argument that he makes is, you know, the powerless actually have a lot of power simply by not doing things the state wants you to do, however minor they are, not putting up a sign in your window that says, long live the proletariat, not turning in the television for the news to hear state propaganda. Those are actions of real power. And so what I think I want to be even more mindful of is that we all have this power, even at times when it seems like we're up against impregnable odds.
Carol, which former Soviet republics do you feel have been the most successful on their own as independent nations?
Well, I think it's a two-pronged question. I think some of the states that have fared the best, certainly economically, and one could certainly say politically, have been the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. Those are states that have had strong traditions of nationalism. They were only occupied by the Soviet Union in 1939, 1940. And they have benefited a great deal both from that tradition, but also from being integrated into the European Union. And the kind of infrastructure that the EU has brought, certainly the kind of funding that it has brought, has helped them a great deal. At the same time, and this is the flip side of the coin, there are certain authoritarian states, especially in Central Asia, like Kazakhstan, that have benefited from their natural resources and have done well in economic indicators, but have remained very far from democratic states. And I think you can count Russia among those as well. So, to my mind, the political successes have come in states that have been able to develop strong institutions, strong parliaments, separations of powers, judiciaries, the kind of stuff that so many of us feel is under attack in Poland today. And the states that have failed to do so, even if they have significant resources, are, I think, heading for trouble, heading certainly for tension. And we're seeing some of those tensions erupt already in both Central Asia and Russia.
I read that you talk a little bit about the variety show transnationally. Can you talk about that and how that ties into your work?
Yeah, so this may sound disconnected from everything I've talked about so far, but it's really not, because I alluded to the role of mass politics and this moment in which nationalism becomes a feature of political life. That is also the era in which the variety show becomes the most popular form of art. And the variety show is weird. It's deliberately weird. It has opera singers and sword swallowers and lion tamers. And crucially, it also has thousands and thousands of people in the audience. And so in the late 19th, early 20th century, these variety shows played a huge role in creating new national identities. This was an era in which notions like Germanness, Englishness, Frenchness were up for debate. And variety shows played a crucial role in ways that are still with us, that are still left over in the language. So something that is striking to me is our words, chauvinism, is a product of the variety show. It's a character named Chauvin, who was an actor in a bit play for the variety show. So many of our so much of our language, especially about national identity, about nationalism, comes from there. And while that genre has faded away, I do think art and culture continue to play that role, both in defining the words we use, also in defining our preoccupations. You know, it's been striking now that we are in this country in the midst of a movement of really unveiling, speaking about sexual harassment, other forms of harassment. When you look at where it started, it's Bill Cosby and Louis C.K., and it is cultural figures, it is Hollywood, it is our films and movies. Those are the sites where these conversations are starting. And so I think clearly the forms of culture have changed, but the role that culture plays in defining political priorities and shaping our discourse is still very much alive.
How do you even research this idea of the variety show, or arts in general, in governments that control the media and the message?
Well, in many ways, it's easier to do it in states that do control it. And so the book that I'm writing now about culture in the Soviet bloc is able to use government materials, is able to actually get inside the halls of power and trace the ways in which politicians were constantly talking about culture, the ways in which they really invested very heavily in theater, in film, painting, as ways of spreading their political message, and conversely, the ways in which they were truly terrified of arts and culture, the way in which a rock concert, a gathering of people, was a fundamental political threat. There were several revolutions, in fact, in Eastern Europe, including in Poland in 1968, that started in theaters. So you can do this, in my case, through looking at government records. But what that teaches us, I think, is that while that connection may be easier to recognize in a dictatorship, it's equally true for all states. It's not just authoritarian regimes that rely on culture to shape politics. And I think there's a really fruitful field there and a lot to pay attention to in terms of how artists continue to be essential in our political system.
Thank you so much, Kirill Kunakovich, professor of history at the University of Virginia. Nancy, we hit the jackpot today. Great guest. I'm going to corner you also. Will you come back?
I'd be delighted to come back.
Yes, great. Please. Yes.
I think
we're not that smart yet. So
we're not that smart, and you guys deliver the message in a way that is very digestible and very helpful. Yes. So thank you so much for doing that.
Yep.
So, Nancy?
Yes. Oh, can I be psychic again, or do you have a music cue? There it is.
The palate cleanser. Yes, go ahead.
Speaking of, I want to live in that world of that tune. All right, my palate cleanser, because I know we're running out. My best alternate universe, Ellen, is returning on November 21st. HGTV's Fixer Upper.
I'm so happy.
Coming back. Sadly, though, it's its final season. 19 more episodes of to be, you know, distracted by shiplap and open concept kitchens and reclaimed wood. It's all starting next 21st, whatever day that is. And then, of course, looking forward to Mr. Mueller's Fixer Upper for the nation.
Oh, yes.
Tie-in.
Good time.
Anyway, what do you got?
I'm happy for you because I know how you love that show. I have a really funny. There was a real grasshopper found in a Van Gogh painting in the paint.
I didn't know any of this.
In Kansas City, I think it was this week, in his painting called Olive Trees. It wasn't complete. It was dismembered, but it was part of the grasshopper in the paint.
That is so cool.
I know. It was like a gem that I found to talk to you about.
Until they shut down museums, we should go check out that grasshopper.
I wanted to say that if anyone just caught part of this interview today and you want to catch, you missed it and you're bummed out, you can go to 947wpvc.org, look for Apropos of Something. We have about 32 shows, or exactly 32 shows there.
And if they're bummed out or not bummed out, leave us a tweet on our Twitter page, AOS Radio. We want to hear from you. Whatever you
know,
got,
I really
hear about it.
It's like we don't know who's out there. Give us a holler and let us know. We really would really, really, really appreciate it.
There you
so
go.
So thank you to our guests, Melvin Loeffler, Kirill Kunakovich. You guys with I'm stumbling today, but we were helped out by our great guests. We'll see you next week. And remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone must do something. See you, Nance.
Indeed. Yep.